This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 19, 1972, part 2.
Romita was, as I say, more of a Romita and Ross Andrew were more direct collaborators. Romita, in particular, I deferred to Romita because, as I say, he was the senior partner in it, and he obviously knew everything much better than I would have known. So when I was working with John, I would run ideas by him. He would take them and develop the story, visually. And I don't think I ever wrote a full length plot for him after the first one that I did. With Gil Kane, Gil was very inventive visually and was a good storyteller, but he didn't really contribute to plot. His contributions were in terms of the overall design, layout, and storytelling of the issues that we did together. And because he was kind of known for sometimes pacing things a little bit awkwardly, where he would use, like, say, if you gave him a 3-page plot, he might end up doing the first page over the first 16 pages of a 20-page book, and you end up with everything crowded into the last 4 pages.
Place to Be Nation, Pop, welcome back to the latest installment of the Marvel Age podcast, your year-by-year journey through the publishing history of the Marvel Universe. We have made it all the way up to our second part, covering 1972. We have a new batch of 20 somewhat unique and eclectic issues here to talk about. And I, of course, am your host, Nick Duke, but I could not do this podcast alone. Joining me, as always, are the other members of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you tonight?
Greetings, Mr. Nick Duke. Wow, as I struggle to get that out. As you know, I am a quasi-motivational destruct organ. Now, this, of course, means I am programmed to sow negativity and discord, but I'm so lazy that I'm only quasi-motivated to do it. So I will just endeavor to be generally annoying and hard to take on this episode here tonight.
That is how we all prefer you, I believe. Moving on to a man who I'm going to give an ultimatum. He can choose to do this podcast or he can choose to marry me. He cannot choose to do both. Todd, how are you tonight?
Yes, because if I were to finish nursing school, why?
Podcasting school, I think.
Podcasting school.
In this analogy.
Well, there's a tangent there, and we can maybe talk about that later, but it's true.
Podcasting school, of course, is taught by our good friend Ben Morse.
Yes, that was the tangent I was going to take us on. But I've got a bad case of creeping paranoia right now.
Mm.
Yeah, everybody's nice. Trying to get my aunt, and my gosh, we'll talk about that. Why somebody's so concerned about his aunt when he should be more concerned about Flash Thompson stealing his girl.
Ooh.
Flash Thompson is the biggest jackass known to man. Rounding out the panel, the other half of the Southern contingent, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
Doing better than Avengers issue 100, and that's not a prediction, that's a spoiler.
There are probably entire wings of children's hospitals doing better than Avengers 100, but that's neither here nor there.
I'm pretty sure that issue gave certain children back in the 70s cancer.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you brought it up, so there's no better place to just go ahead and dive right in, because we are in the middle of a year here in 1972. We might as well go and get started, and we start with Avengers 100, an anniversary issue here for Marvel's quote-unquote flagship team. In full disclosure, we were originally going to record this podcast about 3 weeks ago and wound up having to bump for personal reasons, largely on my part.
It's because we all read Avengers 100 and we've been struggling to recover.
We
since
lost
then.
Our will to continue. So I read Avengers 100 back then. I remember practically none of it other than it sucked and it was a chore to get through. Somebody help me out here. What was this book even about and why did I hate it so much?
It doesn't have a plot, so don't worry there. It's basically just a roll call. How many people can we fit into a single Avengers book and still not have a plot? Well,
oh,
Roy Thomas
so it's
is
like
here.
The Kurt Busiek Avengers. I get
yeah.
it.
And Avengers Red I still haven't read, so I can't comment there, but I'll take your word for it. The most notable thing that happens in this book is a splash page that Marvel Unlimited kind of didn't do so hot on right at the beginning where it cuts off, well, Hank Pym's right elbow and makes Pegasus look like he is somewhat one half higher than the other should be. Not to mention the fact that apparently, according to Barry Smith, Thor and the Black Knight both have scoliosis. And I guess we'll have throughout the rest of this issue. I made it 13 pages into this before I Seinfeld gift out, and that's about all I can say for it is, my God, this is almost a 9-panel grid style comic with loads and loads of useless dialogue and art that looks like Barry Smith was just as in a hurry to get through this book as we were to try and read it.
There you go. Todd or Tim, yeah. Whoever wants to take it over next.
Well, I was just going to say that, and I'm not going to take it over necessarily, but administrative note, continuing the theme of full disclosure, this was actually the conclusion of a 3-part story, which we did not read the first 2 parts of because, well, they're Roy Thomas Avengers comics. The last issue of this series we read was 97. That was the ending of the Kree-Skrull War, which we weren't terribly enthusiastic about. Skipped 98 and 99, jumped right to 100, really only because it was an anniversary issue, and I just kind of want to hit those if we can, unless there's an overwhelming reason not to. And I don't know. I don't think I would have hated myself if I left this off the list, guys.
Yeah, I understand you kind of feel obligated because it is a big anniversary book, but man, Todd, your thoughts here.
It's a nice cover.
Mm-hmm. It is that.
At least you can find the positive, Todd. That's what I like about you. Always looking for the positivity here when it comes to the Avengers.
Yeah, there was Avengers versus not the Asgardians, but the Olympians. Yeah, and it was a bunch of hoo-ha involving the Enchantress, and we had the Swordsman and the Black Knight, and it was just stupid and worthless. But Hulk got to sit down and listen to flute music played by Satyrs. So there's that. Pretty goofy, man. Not fun, though. Sometimes goofy can be fun. This was not fun. This was a chore and just an excuse to get all the Avengers in there. But again, fine cover.
As I recall, the plot, such as it was something having to do with Ares taking over Olympus and Hercules kind of falling from grace. And this is occasion to get all the Avengers together for a big jam up reunion, which, I mean, sounds suitably epic. It ought to be halfway readable, and somehow it just isn't. I think that we have read comics that are less competently put together than this, comics that are certainly longer than this, but are still a lot more readable. And I just really struggled, man. And it just, I'm looking at my notes and I literally have a mash of keystrokes, which signified my frustration in trying to get through this. And much like Russell, I didn't finish it. And that's a rarity. I mean, I really try to.
Yeah, how many pages was this? It was oversized, right?
Not really. I mean,
maybe 21 pages.
Oh, yeah. Man. It just felt oversized.
Extra page. And it just caused me to enact a new policy. And that's very simply, when a comic is so anti-entertaining that in the process of trying to read it, you kind of feel yourself inching ever closer to death. And that death is coming sooner than it would otherwise. If you were doing anything other than reading that comic, then you need to just stop. Just put it down. No matter what the comic is, put it down. Never return. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Bigger things in life.
So this policy will probably be put to the test on our next episode when we cover more Avengers books, I'm assuming.
Well, we are nearing the end of Roy Thomas's run, so...
It can only get better from here?
I think so.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
I mean, like, I keep hoping, and I know it's useless, but I keep hoping that each issue of Avengers we've reached the bottom, that we can scrape this barrel no further. But Roy Thomas will defy all logic. He will make sure we continue to scrape.
He really does. And I hate to dog on him so much because I don't think on the whole he's an atrocious writer. We have read other stuff by Roy Thomas that's been fine to good. I think there's something coming up even in this batch of issues, if I recall, that I was pretty okay with. But I don't know if he's just ill-fitting for this series or his sensibilities don't suit like the varsity team iconic superheroic approach of a series like Avengers or what it is. But
I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, it really just has not clicked. And I know we kind of say the same thing with like every Roy Thomas Avengers story that we read, and it is getting rather old, I'm sure. So I'm trying not to beat a dead horse, but it is a bit more of the same.
A dead Pegasus.
a dead Pegasus, yes. A dead Satyr. I don't know.
Tim, the horse is not dead. The horse at this point has died, buried, been resurrected as a Black Lantern, and is back like haunting us throughout. Yeah. So the horse has been through it.
Skeletal at this point.
Yeah. It's glue.
It's the glue that's holding this show together.
Let's move on. Yeah. Comic. I can't. Mm-hmm. I this was bad. And we did get to see the ancient Black Knight. Remember that part. That was kind of cool. You know,
we did.
A little bit of explanation for those of us who appreciate the Black Knight.
Thank you, Todd. You're welcome. Well, I would like to say that the Barry Windsor Smith art was also a plus, but I can't
still
really.
Still evolving.
It's still evolving, and particularly when he inks himself, that's where you get things like characters having scoliosis. it almost looks like something out of a Golden. Well, I think it is, because the art is very uneven in this issue, to say as much as we've already said of the writing. No more on that. But it almost looks like art from a Golden Age comic. It's I don't know what. And we're many, many years, decades removed from the Golden Age now. So, Todd, I think you said it best. Barry Windsor Smith still evolving to his credit.
Yeah, absolutely. And we won't get to see the Conan stuff that everybody raves about with him. But maybe someday we'll read some fine Uncanny X-Men that he's done.
Definitely.
Perhaps we will. Moving on to another book that I read weeks ago and have forgotten most of the details of, Fantastic Four 124 to 125. This is a storyline entitled The Return of the Monster, and it's notable for it being Stan Lee's final Fantastic Four story in the pages of the main title. So interesting little story here, not as good as some of the other FF that we've read, but I have to say I remember reading this immediately after Avengers 100, and I think virtually anything would have felt like pretty damn good compared to that. And so I remember like not overall hating this the way it perhaps arguably deserves to be hated. Tim, what did you make of this one?
I felt much the same also reading it right on the heels of Avengers 100. I guess the plot here, the titular monster, is a callback to an earlier issue that we did not cover because it was a very one-off story with this creature who was sort of similar to like the 50s monster books, I gather, that Lee and Kirby were doing. And just one of those throwaway villains you would have never expected to see again. And for whatever reason, they bring him back here, and this is Stan Lee's swan song here on FF. He took a break for a little while there. Archie Goodwin came in. Lee came back, and now this is it for him. So going out with a bit of a whimper, is he not? You know, it just goes to show how different things were at the time, how these books were not by any means creator-driven, and there wasn't this frenzy and cult of personality around the people who were making the comics. They were just sort of, even someone like Stan Lee, just sort of thought of as a hired gun, and with very little fanfare, he wraps up his run, and maybe on the letters page gets a nice send-off, but that's going to be the extent of it. And it's just sort of how things were done back then. My, how they change. So just on that historical note, I figured we should include this little two-parter. Easy enough to read as it was, but unremarkable in terms of the events within the pages themselves.
Good point. Todd, your thoughts here.
Yeah, this was mostly comfort food. You had a nice kind of story about a misunderstood monster, this creature from the Lost Lagoon. Story was pleasant enough, except for Martyr Reed collapsing from exhaustion because he's been doing so much to save the world. But, you know, we get a tale of the monster is not really a villain at all. He needs their help, yada, yada. I am confused as to why Johnny in flame form has hair now.
Yes,
all of a sudden.
Thank you.
Maybe this was a short experiment to differentiate him from the returning original Human Torch as seen in Invaders.
I didn't think of that.
So maybe that, but it doesn't work, and it's only for this few sets of issues, I believe. Otherwise, you have, you know, the classic FF tropes that work so well. Thing being antagonistic and funny, and Sue being helpless, Reed being a dick. But we love Fantastic Four, and congratulations, Stan Lee, for writing so many of them. That's a pretty amazing achievement. But yeah, Marvel was, like we were talking about, the cult of personality of writers. Marvel had a Marvel writing style. You know, you could read a comic by, say, Jerry Conway or Archie Goodwin and not necessarily know who had done it at this point. The only one who seems to stand out is when Roy Thomas is bad, he's really bad. Really bad. Really, really bad.
Right. Or when fucking Steranko was able to write some stuff.
Yeah.
That stood out a good deal to me.
Good point.
But for the most part, you're correct in this assessment. Moving on. Oh, sorry, Russell, your thoughts here on Fantastic Four.
Pretty much what Todd said. Pretty even, like, not exactly filler issue of Fantastic Four, but it feels pretty stock and, like, you know, par for the course for Stan Lee. So it kind of goes out as I think, as Tim said, on a bit of a whimper. It's okay, but you know, you got Thing and Human Torch playing their usual dynamic, which is fun. Sue being put into, you know, yet again, a damsel in distress situation, and Reed being useless. So there's all the tropes of everything a Fantastic Four story usually has at this point. Calling back to a story that we didn't cover, that part did keep me kind of, you know, in the dark as to what exactly is happening here. I felt like I should know something that I just didn't. But by the time we get to the end of it, I was like, okay, that was the long way around to get to this explanation there, Stan, but that's about par for the course for you on this book. So, yeah, we took the scenic route to get to the end of a story that probably could have been done in a single issue had they not just stretched this one out. But overall, it was okay. Artwork wasn't bad, and it was it was certainly a huge step up from Avengers 100.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Speaking of the art by John Buscema, pretty solid. There is a scene where Reed Richards gets x-rayed, and we see he has normal bones. And did the concept of Mr. Fantastic even having bones, like, really oog anyone else out?
You know, it
like,
does
what now. What happens with those bones when he's using his powers? I mean, it's just, what's going on? this is very unsettling and getting into body, unintentional body horror now.
Well, that is your favorite genre, as I recall, Tim.
It is my favorite horror genre.
That would put a whole new spin on Fantastic Four and would have made this issue more interesting if they steered into that instead of the doctors who are examining him just glossing over the whole, yeah, we totally understand how his powers work. We know everything about him, and everything here looks normal.
That was very strange.
Yeah, it was like, we're experts in the field of whatever in the hell these people are. So, yeah, it's all good.
Very good.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to something that's a little bit more appropriate, being that we are recording this very close to Halloween, because when last we convened for an episode of Marvel Age, we talked about kind of this, the springing up of horror titles across Marvel, a batch of titles, whether it be Tomb of Dracula or whether it be this one we're about to talk about, Werewolf by Night, that debuted in the pages of Marvel Spotlight. Well, here in this episode, we covered Marvel Spotlight number 4, but then we also got to see Werewolf by Night spin off into his own title, Werewolf by Night number 1. We'll talk about these together since the story pretty much directly continues from one right into the other. A little interesting here. I have to say I didn't enjoy them plot-wise as much as I did the early Jack Russell appearances that we read in the last episode, but I continue to enjoy kind of the tone of them and the art. I'm continuing to be very impressed by. Not a big fan here of this, I don't even know what her name was, but he kept calling her a Gorgon, this mutant character he comes into contact with and has to fight over the course of 2 issues. But I don't know, still something about this, I guess it's different enough from the other stuff we're reading that I'm kind of being kinder on it than it probably deserves. Todd, what did you make here of these 2 Werewolf by Night stories we read?
These were great. I don't know what you're thinking. I'm just kidding. This is decent stuff. Again, we have the low expectations for a book like this, but it continued the bar that was set in that first 2 issues. And, you know, we're getting into a little bit weird stuff with the father and the daughter turns on him and the heel, the Darkhold is referenced again. We wait till almost the last 2 or 3 pages of the issue, it feels like, for the werewolf to come out. But there's so much crammed into these, and it's written very well. I do like the narrative as though you're reading the diary of Jack Russell later, after, you know, as though it's a classic novel or something like that. And it's interesting that the way that it broke up, you know, we were talking about this before, or we had to take our hiatus. These 2 books are consecutive, and yet the second one starts in a totally different title name. So if you were picking up Werewolf by Night number 1, you were only getting the second half of a story. So it had kind of be a unique situation for readers. I flesh out the supporting cast with this writer, Buck Cowan, who is kind of a weirdo. I'm not sure where they were going with this guy and his salty demeanor, but he provides a nice contrast to Jack, and we get the Medusa-type character who leaves us with the ultimate cliffhanger. You know, she turns the werewolf to stone, and we get a new series. I think it's still very high quality for the time, and again, pleasant surprise, because I had zero, and I mean zero, expectations before we got to our last podcast episode for this. So I'm still enjoying this at this point.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Russell, your thoughts?
Pretty similar to Todd. I enjoyed these issues. Probably didn't enjoy them quite as much as Todd did. I thought that the artwork was a little bit of a step down from some of the previous Werewolf by Night stuff that we read. Plot-wise, there is something to this. I kind of like the idea of him encountering other supernatural-type characters who can be can act as foils or villains for him. The Medusa-style character was interesting, was a nice twist. But I think, it's like I said before in our offline chat, Marvel pretty much makes a big error here, in my view. They have this story going on in Marvel Spotlight, And they don't conclude the story there. They decide to launch a Werewolf by Night ongoing. And the first issue, issue one, is the conclusion of the story they started probably like two, like back in Marvel Spotlight, whatever issue it was Werewolf by Night originally appeared in. Like this has been kind of an ongoing saga with him that wraps up its first, like one of its big chapters in a first issue. And to me, that was like shooting yourself in the foot. If people see that number one, they pick that up, they're going to think, oh, well, this is a really great starting point. Well, Werewolf by Night number one is a horrible starting point. Mm-hmm. You are going to be as lost as you can possibly be as to what's been going on up to this point. And while they do put in the expositionary dialogue boxes or narration boxes to help you get caught up on what's been happening, that's really doing a disservice to the people who've already been reading up to this point and already knew all this. And it's an example of tell, don't show for people who've never picked up a book. So it's like, oh, I didn't come here to read a prose novel. I came here to read a comic. The plot still, it's great. Jerry Conway's script is solid stuff. It gets you, if you've been reading up to this point, it's interesting. You're going to want to keep going, but if you are somebody who's curious about a horror title and Werewolf by Night seems interesting to you, I would recommend reading it, but make sure you go back and read Marvel Yes. Spotlight way before you jump on Werewolf by Night, because if you do, you'll probably just put the book back down and never come back to it. Might be why this book didn't have more success in the long run.
Interesting. Interesting. Tim, your thoughts here?
Yeah, Russell, you set me up nicely. I was going to say pretty much the same thing, that bizarre production decision to split this story across separate titles, and with one of them being the debut titular series for Werewolf by Night. Just think, to say nothing of the readers at the time, but if we had read Werewolf by Night number one without reading the preceding three issues of Marvel Spotlight, we would have savaged this story.
We would have hated this.
There's You know we would.
Yeah, we would have, for sure.
I mean, and they kind of did the same thing. I hesitate to make this comparison with Captain Marvel, which Captain Marvel, at the end of the day, just kind of sucked because it was Captain Marvel and it was some Roy Thomas at his very Roy Thomas-iest. But we did not cover, like, even that character's origin in the anthology, what was it, Marvel Superheroes Quarterly, whatever the hell that was. And that debut issue really, really suffered even more than probably it otherwise would have. And, yeah, for that reason, I kind of almost don't want to heap too much praise on Werewolf by Night number one. But that's, you know, no knock against the creators themselves. I think that this story and this script by Jerry Conway gives you a little more something than just the sort of mundane, pulpy trash it is presented as in terms of just the plot. Something about his dialogue. Jerry Conway has a great way of writing expository dialogue that does not feel expository, which is a great gift, I think, as a comics writer. The art by Mike Plug continues to be very, very distinctive and striking. He would not be a great fit for a lot of series, a lot of, you know, superhero stuff. You couldn't really see him on, but he works great here. So I really enjoy the creators. I enjoy the story such as it is split across two books like this. You know, some of the shifting character motivations towards the end are, I don't know, don't totally work out in the wash, but it's still enjoyable. And I like that transformation sequence that
yes,
really, really does a lot to emphasize the anxiety and the dread of Jack Russell's condition. It's hard to say Jack Russell with a straight face without laughing. But again, this body horror, right, that I go back to. I guess when you see body horror and everything, you're always looking for it. It's, you know, it's going to really come across when it's done well. And he also has that kind of Spider-Man dilemma, you know, where he's that kind of identifiable protagonist, and he doesn't want to let his friends and family down. But at the same time, he's got to protect his dual identity. This having more of a horror bent to it than the action adventure of Spider-Man comics. So it's sort of as a horror answer to Spider-Man. This really does work for me. So I don't know how many other occasions we'll have to check in on this series, but I liked what we've seen of it. I've enjoyed this little journey of really four issues we've covered here with Werewolf by Night.
As have I. While we're on the horror topic, I'm actually going to change up our format a little bit and talk about another horror-themed title that we got to dive into on this reading list, and that would be a couple of short stories in the pages of Adventure into Fear that introduce us to, and I've been waiting this entire podcast to say this, to the Man-Thing. We are finally meeting the Man-Thing who will one day be the giant-sized Man-Thing and all things that are man. So I don't know about you guys, but I like this a lot, actually. It's interesting. We have some early Howard Chaykin contributions on art. I don't even know who wrote this, but good stuff here. Jerry Conway writing this again. And
he wrote issue 10 and Steve Gerber.
Oh, interesting.
Issue 11. Yeah.
That's interesting because I like 10 a little bit more than I liked 11 just because of I think the simplicity of the story.
Mm-hmm.
11, when you get into the stuff with the kids and the demons, not as enjoyable to me. But 10 here sees the titular man thing basically saving a child an infant who has been thrown from from a bridge. A character that I'm presuming is his father, and then later on delivering justice upon this individual, and then 11 sees him fighting a demon that has accidentally been conjured by two small children somehow. But as silly as that sounds, I don't know. I liked both of these issues artistically, narratively, everything about it kind of worked for me. What'd you think, Tim?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And these went down really easy. They're just like little 10-pagers in this anthology series, parentheses, Adventure into Fear. So got to love that parenthetical there in a mm-hmm. series title.
It's like open parentheses, 500, close parentheses, Days of Summer, which is perfect. What I always refer to that movie as, because if you're going to have pretentious
Andy rom-com
situation, you're gonna own that shit.
That's right. So rather far removed tonally from that is this series, but continuing that horror trend, I almost wonder, and I keep asking what was going on in pop culture to really ignite, and we've talked about this a little bit and speculated what was happening just in the pop culture landscape to ignite or perhaps reignite this horror trend. And I don't know that we came to any real conclusions in the early 70s. But they have produced – it's produced some pretty enjoyable comics here. So we get Conway and Howard Chaykin. So our first exposure here to Howard Chaykin art, certainly someone who would go on to become very influential in the industry, to win this little 10-page story in Fear, number 10. I continue to enjoy Jerry Conway's writing. He is probably a much, much better horror author than he gets credit for, because he's been dipping his toes into this pond. He's written just about every horror series character book that we've encountered, I believe, up to this point. Even some of the stuff in which we will be talking about later, Amazing Adventures with Beast, not itself a horror series, but very horror influenced, especially that first issue by Jerry Conway. So, maybe he doesn't get a fair shake in that regard. I know that this particular story was going for kind of a more hopeful conclusion where Man-Thing doesn't completely like obliterate these people, but kind of wish he'd had. I don't know if that's just the cynicism in me or the mood I was in when I read this, but I wasn't fully sold on that ending despite understanding what it was going for. But all in all, it's kind of a decent human interest type of story. And yeah, our introduction to Man-Thing proper. He had debuted in a magazine publication called Savage Tales, I think, in 1970. Was not on Marvel Unlimited, perhaps by virtue of the fact that it was a magazine. And I think that they did that to kind of get around things like Comics Code approval. If you publish something in a magazine format, you don't need to have that Comics Code stamp. I did read that, and I won't say there was anything that seemed like it jumped out at me as being totally against the code, but maybe other stuff in that publication was. I don't know. I don't know what decision motivated that to appear in a magazine format rather than just a comic. But anyway, here he is in comics now. And yeah, we will perhaps stick with this guy for a little bit. We get our first Steve Gerber story as well in issue 11. And that has Rich Buckler art. Yeah. Pretty wacky, pretty unusual, but also very Steve Gerber to the point that, to the extent that I've been exposed to his writing anyway, which is not a lot. And I'm looking forward to more from him. I am wondering if one of the children in this issue who, you know, conjures these spirits, her name is Jennifer. And I know that there's a mystical character called Jennifer Kale in Marvel Comics. And I don't know. I'm wondering if that's meant to be the same character, if this is her first appearance or if it's just a coincidence. Maybe we'll find out. Not an expert in that realm by any means.
Awesome. Glad to hear you enjoyed it. Russell, your thoughts here on the Man-Thing. How do you feel about Man-Thing?
Well, he is certainly giant-sized.
Mm.
Yes. I really
my boy, how giant-sized is he?
Oh, he's bursting at the seams, you see. He's the size of a tree trunk. He kind of has a tree trunk hanging from his face. I enjoyed this pretty well. I like the Howard Chaykin art, especially on 10. I thought was really great. Very breezy issues. I mean, they're only like 10 and 11 or 10 and 16 pages each. The first issue really just kind of breezes by because the way I feel like Jerry Conway is kind of helping to usher in that new way of writing comics by allowing the artwork to tell most of the story without overloading narration boxes or dialogue. And also appreciated that we get a little quick like retread of Man-Thing's origin here so that you kind of get a little bit of where he's coming from and how he kind of interconnects to the world around him. So since we didn't actually get to read that first appearance of Man-Thing, which I assume probably had his origin story in it, this was a nice way of calling back to something like that. And of course, it's very it's Swamp Thing-esque if you're familiar with the DC character.
His origin is very Swamp Thing-esque.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's
guess which one came first.
So to Man-Thing, speak. Wasn't it?
Yes, but 2 months.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so They probably had some wind of what was coming over at Marvel. And, you know, man, these were pretty good. I, like Nick, I enjoyed 10 more than I liked 11. 11 got into some odd territory at times, but overall still written really well and entertaining enough that it kept me going through the issue and made me want to see what else they got for all this. Though I think Jerry Conway is the far superior idea guy and plotter scripter for a title like this. So he's got a mind for horror, and his Werewolf by Night stuff, of course, was great. And then, of course, this I dig it. I think that it's fairly well done.
Outstanding, great to hear. Todd, how did you warm up to Man-Thing?
Yeah, not much to add there. Enjoyed the first story more than the second as well, but still more enjoyable as a concept than I would have thought. I will continue to look forward to reading more of these. I would like to say we should keep our eye on this Steve Gerber kid. He is a different sort of cat, if you will. Tim, that is indeed Jennifer Cale's first appearance.
No kidding.
It is true. That? Yeah. So you called that.
Ooh.
You do see the monster again that she summons throughout. I believe that monster appears in... It has its own listing in the handbook of the Marvel Universe, if I recall correctly. Mm. So these were fun, and I got to say, Man-Thing is growing on me.
Good to hear. Good to hear, sir. I hope we get an opportunity to look back in on the Man-Thing at various points in this podcast. Perhaps we will, perhaps we won't. But
I can see that in real life.
In any event, let's move on back over to the more conventional heroic side of things. And let's talk about Daredevil 88 and 89. When last we left old Daredevil, he had moved over to the city of San Francisco with the Black Widow and the Black Widow's father come chauffeur, Ivan.
Isn't that a genre?
Oh, I don't know about that, about fathers and coming and chauffeurs. But okay. Tim, is that a genre?
Yes. Okay. Everything's a genre.
That's a good point. There's so much out there.
Like you like can think of it.
There's so much out there that we just can't even bother to consume it all at any point.
If you can think of it, there's a site for you.
any event, this story kind of deals with the Black Widow is having these mysterious interactions with this guy named Danny French, who at one point pretty much tells her he's not going to give her information unless she sleeps with him, which was a very... You know, just a real nuanced thing to be happening here in 1972. In the meantime, kind of against that backdrop, we've got Daredevil doing battle with both Kilgrave, the Purple Man, and Electro. And then we also get a little bit of a snippet of some backstory here for Black Widow as we look at her interaction with his character Ivan and kind of their how they came to know each other and things of that sort. I liked these. I like these pretty well, actually. It's remarkable how much better Daredevil is than when we first checked in on him early on in his publishing history. And that's not to say it was bad then. It just wasn't, I don't know, there was something missing about it.
Daredevil was bad.
Some of it was bad. Some of it was
readable, but it was bad. Like, it was like not a real comic, kind of bad.
It was better than Avengers or... You know, a lot of the other stuff we were reading from that era, like I'm thinking specifically of the Ant-Man stuff, the early Avengers stuff. It was better than that, to me anyway. But
it wasn't a slog by any means.
Right. And now, I don't know, I'm really enjoying these last few Daredevil issues we've read. And I think a lot of it has to do with that Gene Colan art, which kind of is providing the book with just a different look and feel and something that just, I don't know, it feels more like what we would think of as being having a Daredevil type tone from a modern context, like thinking of Daredevil in through this darker lens or what have you. So I don't know. I'm enjoying the hell out of these. Tim, what about you?
Yeah, about the same. I confess it's been a while since I read this pair of issues, but I do recall really liking them at the time. It's more Jerry Conway goodness. And I agree with you that Gene Colan art carries a lot of this. It is outstanding. Maybe some of the pound for pound, maybe the best art, I think, in this batch of issues that we have really seen and that we will see. So kudos to him. Kind of wild that Kilgrave, we get a footnote back to his earlier appearance in this book, which we did read, but it was very, very long ago in those early issues of Daredevil. And evidently he has not returned since then. So it's like Jerry Conway is mining the backstory here and finding the elements that really worked and bringing them back to the fore, which is a great thing to do in a serialized book such as Daredevil. Ivan. Oh, what can we say about Ivan? He's the type of character I feel like I shouldn't like and should get on my nerves, but he's a little bit of a badass in this story. He basically pulls Daredevil's fat out of the fire and I was sort of into it. He's earning his keep in this book. The Danny French subplot, again, something I think I shouldn't care about, but I'm kind of intrigued. Want to see where that goes. And yeah, I think we will continue to see this story through to its conclusion. I have a good feeling about that.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Todd, your thoughts here on this two-part Daredevil?
I'll say it once, friend. Frisco's my town. Mm-hmm. I don't need some nut in his underwear to tell me how to police it. Got me? This is good stuff. Again, did you know that he's in San Francisco? Because they only tell you every single page, or they show you.
You have to understand how monumental it is to have a Marvel book not set in New York.
It's not
That's true. That's true. I enjoyed the Purple Man, although in my copy he wasn't purple in the first issue, and then he was purple again the second issue.
That was so. In everybody's copy, and I don't know why.
I don't know.
I'm assuming he was wearing one of those Beast-style rubber masks. Is going to be my my
there's your no prize. Yeah, enjoyed it as well. I think Ivan's going to die horribly. I just get the sense that something bad is going to happen to Ivan. I just get that feeling, get that sense. I have no knowledge. I have not skipped ahead. Very much enjoyed the Matt and Natasha dynamic. A little bit different. She again can hold her own and is to me at this point maybe a little more interesting of a character than Daredevil himself. Electro still with the worst mask design ever. But enjoyed his interactions. I think I like the Purple Man exclusive issue in 88, and then bringing in Electro in 89 was okay. But still very good stuff that I just did not expect, again, to be enjoying as much as I am. I think this was kind of this and perhaps Amazing Spider-Man were the two best books that they were putting out at this point on a consistent basis, because this is the fourth or fifth good Daredevil we've read in a row. So.
Yeah, I would have to certainly agree with that sentiment. Russell, what'd you make of Daredevil?
Pretty much the same as Todd. The artwork on this is the first thing I want to talk about. Gene Colan is outstanding. This book is one of my favorite in terms of like the superhero art style books that we've been reading up to this point. This book, both 88 and 89, both really stand out from the rest of the pack. It's so different, and it feels much more like the Daredevil that I'm used to reading. And I've not read many like just ongoing Daredevil runs, but I read every issue of Mark Waid's Daredevil, and reading this made me kind of feel like I was back there. So this run, or like this time on Daredevil, was a big influence on that run. So now I'm getting to see kind of where a lot of that came from. There are threads specifically with the Purple Man stuff here that wind up getting called back to during that Mark Waid era. So this was really cool to go through and kind of see where a lot of that had come from that maybe I wasn't aware of before. I'll agree. I think Black Widow is probably more interesting here than Matt Murdock himself. And I feel like the real story around Ivan, though, he does give us his backstory, like how he allegedly met Natasha by saving her life at one point. I think the real truth is that he's her dad, and this is him trying to look out for her without revealing all the truth to her, so he had to come up with a plausible enough story that people would buy to maintain his level of cover. So I think that's how that's going to wind up turning out. And yeah, that probably does set him up for a big death scene later on down the road. Wasn't expecting to get really anything out of the Danny French stuff, but it winds up being a little more intriguing than initially thought. The only time this book really starts to lose me a little bit is in the climactic battle scene in 89. That's when it starts to get a little wonky and starts to feel like, okay, now we're headed into pretty stock superhero stuff for this time period. And it doesn't necessarily fit with all the espionage and intrigue stuff that we've done up to this point. So that's a little bit of a weak ending there. But overall, this was real good. and bodes well for anything that we may be reading from Daredevil in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, moving on to the final of our Daredevil, or excuse me, of our issues before we take a break. We're going to talk about the debut of one of Marvel's flagship African American characters, that of course being Luke Cage, the Hero for Hire. This first issue was certainly a unique situation, is how I would put it. You know, it reminded me a lot of reading that first John Stewart debut issue for DC over in the pages of Green Lantern, where you can't actually, I guess you just can't expect something overly nuanced at this point in history. And so they kind of go over the top with some of the racial overtones and stuff. These caricature-like racist guards who are there just pummeling poor Carl Lucas into an oblivion. But overall, I don't know, despite the goofiness of it, I kind of still enjoyed it, probably more than it deserved, I guess. I don't know. I have a something of a soft spot for these this era of storytelling from both companies, and at least their attempts to introduce some diversity into their lines. You know, Archie Goodwin here with the writing, I don't know that he was the best choice necessarily, but I don't know. It worked out well enough for me, I guess. Russell, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, taking into account the time period, this is still not as bad as some of the other stuff we've read, and that was kind of surprising. I was expecting this to forego any sense of nuance whatsoever and just go like whole hog into the whole blaxploitation, which it still does, but it gives the character of Carl Lucas a little bit more agency than I expected it to. So on that, that's a positive note. This is a really dense issue too. There's so much that happens in this, yet it does still feel breezy enough. I remember like reading through this a while back. This was one of the first books I read for this episode, and it didn't take me nearly as long to go through it as I thought it was going to once I started to realize just how many panels there were per page and how much was being condensed into this book. And if you watched the Luke Cage series on Netflix and you've seen the origin episode when they finally like reveal where his powers come from, it's kind of amazing to me how much of this issue actually wound up in that book. We're actually introduced to the character of Shades in this, in his comic book form, of course.
Who they race swapped, which I never would have thought would be a thing.
Yeah, that was a bit surprising to me as well. And then you get to the origin of his powers, which is it's like, okay, well, they pulled that almost right from the comic book page and didn't really shy away from it at all. They just said, okay, it was a weird nondescript science experiment that gave him his abilities. And yeah, there was a corrupt guards, a little bit of a you know, I don't necessarily think the whole Fight Club thing was really part of the story, but yeah, this was not too bad, and it's nice to see Marvel trying to introduce some diversity into their lineup up to this point, because it really is the straight white man's club right now, and the world's changing. The 1970s are a very different place than the early 60s, so it's time to move forward for Marvel, and this is a step in that direction. I don't know if you can quite call it the right one at this time, but it does lay groundwork for other writers and artists to come later and really make Luke Cage into something special. So not the worst debut I've ever read. I can say that this is one that's important enough I think people should go and check out, not unlike that John Stewart first appearance that you referenced earlier.
There you go. Todd, what were your thoughts here?
I have now read Luke Cage's first appearance. It was good, not great, very densely packed, and Russell, you, again, great minds or mediocre minds think alike, but I was pleasantly surprised with how much the plot of this issue was shown in the Luke Cage origin episode of the Netflix series. So good on them for really honoring the creators. It says, even though Archie Goodwin wrote the first issue, that Stanley or Roy Thomas and then John, art director John Romita, probably had a more of a hand in creating the outline for the character. It's Roy Thomas. Okay, so I will bypass that. I really like the cover as well, and I think it's very strong. I don't know if that's Romita himself doing that, because I don't think it's George Tuska necessarily. Has a different feel. We learned the story of Reva, and we even get Diamond back in there, and he is as annoying as he was in the series, the TV show as well.
Yeah.
but again, not the worst, not the best, good for what it is trying to do, and we have a new player on the Marvel Universe scene in Luke Cage, the Hero for Hire, not yet called Power Man. I did think that one of the wardens reminded me of Peter Pettigrew / Wormtail, and the other warden who replaced him was clearly Gregory Peck. So
yes,
so good stuff by George Tuska with his photo referencing. And I look forward to seeing what happens, especially down the road when he meets Iron Fist.
There you go. Tim, are you going to give this something of the pass the way we have?
I'm not even going to call it a pass, really. As a matter of fact, I will go so far as to say that I think Luke Cage, I dare say, is Marvel's first Bronze Age superhero. That's not something I was really thinking going into this, but when I start to unpack it, and there definitely is a lot to unpack in this very dense issue, as you guys have said, you have an origin story that is, and I apologize because I don't know how to say this without it sounding racist, but, and that's not a good start, I realize, but it's this sort of urban version of a Captain America origin, right? And we have this costume that is extremely hokey, but is acknowledged. Like, it's supposed to look this way. It's supposed to be sort of silly because he's playing the part of a superhero. So we're kind of deconstructing this very Silver Age notion of what a superhero is, and especially the Silver Age origin story of a superhero. And we don't see a whole lot of it get development here, but the idea is he's going to be this hero for hire, right? So that is an excellent angle for a character to explore going into the 1970s, this new decade, where you've got this great power, great responsibility approach that fuels so many classic iconic characters. And it's admirable, but it's weird, right? And it's sort of old-fashioned, this idea that a hero must suffer. And it does make for pretty good stories to read on the comics page, but when you unpack it, as I've tried to do here, there's not like a good internal logic to that. There's not a real explanation to it unless you've got a really fleshed-out character like Peter Parker. But I think there's a school of thought that says, why shouldn't your superhero want to earn a living for what he does? You know, we don't begrudge policemen or firefighters or medical professionals being compensated for their service and their skills. It's only in comics, only really in Silver Age comics, that we have this expectation that risking your life has to be done for purely altruistic reasons, and really only in the hero spear time also. So that's, I don't know, it's a very weird notion. It's very Silver Age, and this book is totally trying to distance itself from that. It's not doing this morality test. I mean, this character, he is a felon. He's wrongly convicted. It makes pains to show us that, but it's saying this is kind of the system, this is the world we live in, and he is a product of that. So I think just on that level, just in terms of what it's doing differently, it really works. Perhaps Archie Goodwin is not the greatest choice of writer here, but I don't know. I guess the Marvel bullpen didn't have any black friends. I don't know what to say on that, really, other than that the script was not as cringy as I was fearing going into it. Art by George Tuska. Have we seen anything else from him?
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah. Don't think so. But all in all, taken as a total package, you could do a lot worse. And I think it's a little bit underrated just in terms of how revolutionary it is for this medium.
Outstanding. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half of this episode. We are going to take a quick break. Stick with us through the break. When we come back, we are going to have looks in on The Beast in the pages of Amazing Adventures, The Incredible Hulk in his own title, Spider-Man in both Marvel Team-Up and his own title, The Defenders in Marvel Feature, and the debut of Night Nurse. You will want to stick around for that, I promise you. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
What's up, Place to Be Nation? It's the manager, Todd Weber, here to tell you all about the stuff going on at PlaceToBeNation.com. First up, we've got the Place to Be Nation Pop feed, on which you are listening to this episode of Marvel Age. Last week, Scott Criscolo and Jennifer Smith wrapped up October and our month-long tribute to Halloween with What a Scream, the History of Horror in America special. Every week, Hard Traveling Fanboys come in and they talk about comics. This week they're back with the latest edition of Fix It or Nix It. They talk about Josh Trank's controversial 2015 movie Fantastic Four. We've also got DC For You every week talking about DC Comics. Russell and Todd talked about October's news and notes. This week in the NFL hits every single week. Roger and Johnny talking about the 49ers being the only remaining undefeated team. Hopefully by the time you read this or listen to this, they will still be such. Also have every Monday Brother Sister Rewatch podcast. Kevin and Mary, they are brother and sister, and they are looking at The Office. They are at Office Season 3, Episodes 17 and 18, including Cocktails and The Negotiation. Negotiation. Is that a word? That's the word. On the latest episode of The Great Debate, Andy Atherton had Nate Milton, Peter Winson, and Matt Souza talking about a bunch of stuff in sports and pop culture. Also weekly, Diamond Conversations hits. Hosts Chad B. talks about different things in baseball, different topics, different guests. This week he had Chris Donnelly talking about the 1985 Mets, Doc Gooden, Daryl Strawberry, et al. On the latest episode of Laughing Theater, Andy Atherton's joined by Miranda Berthold to live watch the 1988 Tim Burton classic Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. And oh, look, he just popped up. Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament starting soon on our Facebook page. Go to Place to Be Nation's Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament, and you will be able to vote every single day. It's happening very soon. Over on our wrestling feed of podcast, we've got Where the Big Boys Play classic episode, Parv, Nima Parvini, and Chad Campbell delivered a review of the Great American Bash 1988 on Where the Big Boys Play. Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zanny hosts JT Rizzero talking about his history as a wrestling fan and the founding and growth of Place to Be Nation. Our newest show, With This Ring, we've got a husband and wife team, Ryan and Cindy, looking at five matches and discussing where they place in Ryan's GWWE match list, as well as Cindy's personal list of favorite wrestling matches. Also had the latest edition of the Gold Standard Mothership Place to Be podcast. JT and Scott delivered their 9th annual Halloween Spooktacular. They talked about the Netflix Marvel Universe, and then they were joined to talk boxing with Roger Morissette, Andy Atherton, and Matt Souza, watching the famous upset match of Buster Douglas versus Mike Tyson. I believe it was the upset. Might have been the... it was the upset. It wasn't... It was the only time they fought. Anyway, I'm rambling on the latest episode of PTBN Extreme Freeway Dance. JT, John, and Jenny continue their ECW adventure with three episodes of ECW Hardcore TV from June 1994. Check out PlaceToBeNation.com every single day. We've got weekly columns, including Campus Hot Takes and Glenn's Weekly Walk. There's always something new up there. I know. I'm an administrator for that site. If you're shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner at the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon, and it takes you right to Amazon and helps out PTBN with no cost to you. All right. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Marvel Age podcast. We are glad you stuck around through the break. We hope you enjoyed those advertisements for all the great Place to Be Nation shows on both the wrestling feed and the pop feed. And it just occurred to me that we should be doing the live read, but I forgot. Ooh. Andy, sorry. I apologize to you personally if you hear this. In any event, we're going to just charge right ahead, and we're going to drop in and check in on our good friend Hank McCoy, a.k.a. The Beast, in the pages of Amazing Adventures 14 to 15. These two issues see the Beast taking on a couple of different threats, first in the form of Quasimodo. Tim, help me out here. What's that acronym again?
Quasi-motivational engine of destruction? Okay. Something like that?
It sure is, Stevie.
I've already forgotten.
And also the Griffin, another somewhat unique villain. He's also continuing to have all sorts of personal issues as he has to put on his rubber costume to get intimate with his lady, who he doesn't realize is a spy, including a hilarious scene where she offers to give him a full body rub down and he can't accept because he doesn't have his rubber suit on. And then after she leaves, he says, "I'll never have the chance again." He's convinced he's lost. His only chance to lose his virginity is how I'm reading this story. I gotta be honest, you guys really liked these issues last time. I'm sure you're really gonna like them again. I just don't. It's not for me, and that's fine. I'm gonna let Tim, you're the resident X-Men homer, tell me why I'm enjoying this more than I am.
Well, I'm probably can't, because I just have that inherent built-in bias, and I've acknowledged this before. I don't know if it's just the X-Men truther in me, but I just dig this stuff, these solo adventures of Beast. I don't know if I'd be on board for it, you know, for like an indefinite period, but we're kind of winding down, and the plot is still trucking along. We're keeping a lot of plates spinning here, and that's to the credit of Steve Englehart, who is now the sole writer on this book after Jerry Conway got it off and running. We've still got Tom Sutton on art, which I have enjoyed quite a great deal. It's just got this sort of goofy sincerity to it that is also very human, and I don't know, it just speaks to me. I've been digging this characterization of Hank. the plot, again, is very, like, there's sort of episodic things happening that have that common thread of this conspiracy, which is sort of revealed in the course of these issues to be the secret empire is behind all of it. So this is going to be our first exposure to that group. Yeah, we get Quasimodo in issue 14. And actually, Quasimodo, what it stands for is involuntarily celibate, is what that acronym is meaning.
Four stars.
He is the first incel, and he has this back and forth with Beast where I guess he kind of learns what it is to be human in the course of dying. So nice job there by Steve Englehart. I don't know. I just enjoyed the dynamic between the two of them, even though Quasimodo is quite a mort of a character. We've read a previous appearance by Quasimodo.
Fantastic Four special number 4.
And that Silver Surfer story that gave him the body that he has now was sort of a unique little curio, as I recall. Didn't knock our socks off, but it was one of those early solo Silver Surfer outings that was sort of interesting and okay. But yeah, I kind of didn't expect to see him again, certainly in this series. And then we get the Griffin in issue 15, and he's kind of like a Power Rangers villain, right? One of those.
He does look kind of like Goldar a little bit.
Yeah, yep. He's Goldar, but with the wings, certainly.
Oh yeah, with the wings.
Yeah, which I never understood why sometimes he had wings, sometimes he didn't. But the Griffin always has wings, and he's basically a dude in a suit, but it's implied that the suit is kind of fusing with him. Like, he can't take his mask off, so I don't know if that extends to the talons and the wings as well. But he's the villain of the week, basically. We get a guest appearance by Angel, who proves his worth by getting knocked out and needing to be rescued by Beast, despite the fact that Angel can fly and Beast cannot. So that's Angel for you in a nutshell. Some other things that I found interesting. Beast's fur after his initial transformation was gray. The story takes pains for some reason to tell us this, and then it turned black. So he's continuing to mutate. He had black fur. He had gray fur. Now it's black. But never blue, even though it uses blue highlights in the coloring to just sort of emphasize and give contrast to things. Wasn't meant to be blue. It's supposed to be black. So definitively, this issue states that. I think later on, they kind of settle on it actually being blue, but this guy's going to go through a few more transformations in the course of his history, certainly. Beast also seems to have a healing factor, which that gets lost along the way. But he's taken a lot of damage in these two issues and bouncing back from it pretty quick. So that was something that I really did not know was a thing and just kind of doesn't get talked about anymore. But yeah, I think I really responded to Beast and Angel bonding through their just mutual usage of these uncomfortable bindings to achieve some semblance of normalcy in their civilian lives. That was something I hadn't really thought about, and I'm glad that the story really emphasized. So again, that very humanistic writing by Steve Englehart.
The ties really that bind.
The ties that bind, very much so, literally, figuratively. And yeah, that's about the size of it.
Todd, your thoughts here?
It's getting a little old for me. I think I want more at this point. At least we're kind of getting to the reveal of Who does she work for? Who does number two work for? Actually, she's not number two. And so we also have the reintroduction of a Patsy Walker / Patsy Baxter, who is married to policeman Buzz Baxter.
That's okay. I thought it was Patsy Walker, and then I got thrown off by the Baxter thing, and so I was like, "What the hell?"
Yes,
but thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, and his parents own the Baxter Building. I don't know that. I don't know. But
well,
but I he could be rich.
Should.
Actually,
yeah. They should.
I think they actually did get married in the course of the Patsy Walker solo series.
Okay. So I don't remember. I did Heart. Not read that.
No, well, nobody did. I mean, it was one of those romance comics, basically. So, and that's how Patsy Walker got her start, was in the romance comic trend. Had that long-running series, and this is Steve Englehart just bringing her out of mothballs. And doesn't really call attention to it, but readers seem to catch on.
That, hey, the Beast has one hell of a convincing rubber mask. I got to say. Right. It's a lot for me to buy, you know, that he's able to pass as good old Dr. Henry McCoy or whoever.
So,
yes.
Let's say he had been wearing his rubber suit and they were able to take this full body rub down to its natural conclusion. Does his full body rubber – I mean, is it really a full body rubber suit, and is it
– No.
I'm wondering how form-fitted it is, you know, down there. Down where, you ask, you know where. I don't know.
Isn't it just a mask and gloves? So you would have
so. Yeah.
I don't know, man.
He might have a lot of
plus the bindings. Oh God!
Right. He. Oh. Ooh. Well.
Hey, yeah. He would have
a lot of uncomfortable questions to answer.
And then,
being that she's in the espionage field, she probably has a lot of, you know, hang-ups over bindings and those sorts of things.
Yes. Hopefully not over here, though.
It's the 70s, man. It was in.
That's right.
Russell, what did you think of these?
In Soviet Russia, bindings tie you up. No, that doesn't work. Sorry. Apologize.
Four stories.
Yes. You know, this. I'm more with Tim than anything else. I actually found myself really enjoying these. But these two issues, I got to admit, Tim, they are starting to put a strain on my abilities to look past some of the ridiculousness of it all. The whole rubber suit thing was a stretch to begin with, and that they're just continuing to hammer it home. It's not working for me. It's just too much. At first, the Quasimodo thing was so bad. Like I was starting to get like actively pissed off with the issue for putting him into something that I was actually otherwise enjoying. And the next issue kind of helps it a little bit because they talk about why he was involved at all. Otherwise, it just felt like he just kind of like is plopped into this issue for no reason. Mm-hmm. And the next issue is like, okay, now they've kind of made up for all of that. I understand why Quasimodo was here in the first place. The whole the Secret Empire stuff, I think that's good. I think the angle here is fine. The plot is very workable. The villains are a little too much. The Griffin, though, I will say it works better for me than Quasimodo did, so I can at least like I can get on board with this up to a point. But really, all this accomplishes is making me miss the X-Men that much more. So that's really where this two-parter leaves me, is really, really wishing that these were X-Men comics instead.
Yeah, I pretty much would agree with that.
I will take what I can get, so that's why all this crap.
That's a good point. There are no X-Men comics at this point.
Yeah, it's just sad that this is what we have to settle for instead of having, like, you know, actual X-Men comics. It is also
somewhat odd to me that even of those characters who were introduced to in early X-Men, the Hank McCoy out of all of them got solo adventures. Like, I would have thought, I mean, Jean Grey, Cyclops, Iceman, even a lot of those would have made more sense to me. This was a weird pull, but
You know what I think that is? I think it's a writer's thing. I think that most writers just really love Beast as a character and gravitate to him. Mm-hmm. So even if he isn't the most popular in terms of the original X-Men characters, everybody just seems to really love writing him. So he would get a lot of shine. And, I mean, he's going to be pulling double duty later in the 70s with his Avengers membership and what will become of the X-Men. So we will see.
Roy Thomas still writing that?
The X-Men? There is no X-Men.
No, Avengers.
Oh, you mean by then? Probably not.
Hell no.
Good. Okay, well, at least there's that.
And Nick still won't like it. Nick's not going to like any Avengers till Brian Bendis takes over the book.
I will like Avengers when it's good. I've not read any. These are my genuine feelings on the matter.
I hate to agree with you, but no, it hasn't been good. I think that's turning around. I think it's soon going to turn around. I hope. Knowing the
I
next
I feel like
writer,
we've said that like the last that's what four episodes yeah. that we've recorded.
Okay. I'm not saying we've had any good Avengers yet, but we've had Avengers.
It's coming.
All we've had Stan Lee and we've had Roy Thomas. Let's give it. All right, let me put it this way. How long was it before Justice League was any good?
Oh God, that's
Jerry Conway.
Now I just turned the screws. Mm-hmm.
I would say. Now, granted, it's been many years since I've read it, but I would say Steve Englehart was when it became.
Oh, interesting! You should say that anyway.
Right, because he left one to go do his story at the other. I'm fully aware of the facts of the matter at that time. He couldn't do his Vision story, so he did it with Red Tornado.
Be that as it may, let's continue.
In any event, moving on. Let's go check in on Bruce Banner, the Incredible Hulk, in his own solo title. Here we have issue 150, and what winds up happening here is the Hulk is on the run once again, and in the midst of being on the run, he comes into contact somehow with Lorna Dane and Havoc. He mistakes Lorna Dane for the character of Jarella, the girl he fell in love with all the way back in issue 140, that Harlan Ellison issue we read during 1971. And it's one thing I really like about this issue. Probably the only thing I really like about this issue, let me clarify, is that they are really using that Harlan Ellison issue, that one-off, as like the impetus for his character right now. Like he is trying to recapture that happiness he found in that one issue, and that's really the only time the character of the Hulk has ever been happy, and that's what's kind of driving him right now. And I think that's cool to kind of be, you know, letting that drive continuity, this seemingly random one-off issue. Other than that, it's still a Hulk issue. Like I'm kind of over the whole Thunderbolt Ross thing. It's the same kind of structure to everything each and every time he pops up. I do feel kind of bad for Betty because at the end he's like whispering Jarella's name instead of hers and she's like, "You trifling bitch." you know, but other than that, like I can't find a ton to like here. Russell, what'd you think?
You know, of all the just awful Hulk issues that we've read over the course of this, this was one of the least offenders. This was one that I felt like was a pretty breezy read. Didn't mind Lorna and Havoc in this story, you know, because I'm still hurting for more X-Men and I'm kind of taking what I can get. And man, Havoc's costume sucks. it's just been bad from the jump.
It's Electro-esque.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's Electro levels of bad. What the hell is with this headgear? Nobody has ever made this make sense to me. It's bad. It's real bad. But I really like the callback to the Harlan Ellison issue and that they're using that as the backdrop for everything that's happening with Hulk. That at least gives it some kind of uniqueness to what's come before. Honestly, the ending with Betty here, I felt like was a real nice touch. It was something that added a level of drama to this story that, you know, they probably, you know, haven't had up to this up to now. So I'm it actually made me want to see what comes next for Bruce Banner after this. Did it like really knock my socks off? No, but given some of the other stuff that we read, you know, in this lineup, this was certainly not the worst thing. And I kind of dig the Herb Trimpe and John Severin art. I thought that the book is drawn very well. Horrible costume designs aside, this actually works pretty well as a not exactly maybe a one-off story, but it is in its own right. You can pick this issue up and read it on its own and not feel all that lost, so long as you've read that Harlan Ellison one-off issue, like back in, I believe you said it was 140. Otherwise, it's perfectly fine. It would make me want to read the next Hulk issue, but if the next Hulk issue is just more of this, just more of the same, it'll probably lose me pretty quick.
There you go. Tim, what'd you think?
I think it makes me want to read the next X-Men issue.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah, like Russell said, kind of feasting on scraps here with X-Men appearances such as they are in the early 70s. And I will acknowledge it's a little bit more of a Havoc story than it is a Hulk story. But I think the comic is better in that regard, because I, too, am pretty over the just general Thunderbolt Ross shitness of it all. Same old, same old. Very tired premise and setup there. They really need to somehow move on from that. But with Havoc, we get this little character study, and he's having this crisis of confidence that he sort of works through by kicking the Hulk's ass. So, yeah, I can work with that. And Lorna Dane, with the little callback to Jarella, helps retroactively justify reading that Harlan Ellison issue that was sort of neither here nor there. But she's used to somewhat decent effect here. It keeps that thread running, too. With the Hulk, who is looking for the great lost love of his life, and Banner, of course, supposedly still devoted to Betty, but has that trifling bitch moment at the end where he says the wrong thing. Enjoyed that a lot. I do think that, and Archie Goodwin writes this, by the way, who I think we've enjoyed his writings and what we've seen of it thus far. His Hulk is dumb, but still not quite dumb enough for me. He's still too loquacious. He's real chatty, and I don't know. I don't think of dumb Hulk being that, kind of quippy. So that they really haven't quite settled on his voice yet. Hopefully we will get there. And we talked, we were covering Daredevil, about how the setting of San Francisco is a welcome departure from New York City. Well, Hulk comics are primarily set in the American Southwest. I don't know. I kind of enjoy that. I like how the setting kind of becomes a character onto itself. It just suits and it complements the Hulk as this, lonely and tormented, powerful figure. And in a way, kind of reminds me of Roadrunner cartoons, where the Hulk, he's kind of like Wile E. Coyote, just constantly running into walls and fucking up, set in the American Southwest. So I don't know why I make that connection, but I just do. And it has a certain charm to it. So as a check-in on a pair of X-Men characters, see what they're up to, as a check-in for the Hulk, I think we could have done worse, so no regrets here.
Gotcha. Todd, your thoughts?
Boy, I wish I could say things that Tim didn't say, but I will say a lot of that. This was an Alex Summers character development issue. That was pretty good. And I like your point, Nick, about we still have the through line of Jarella, this quest for Hulk. I was about to say Hulk Hogan. The quest for the Hulk to reunite with his lost love, forever shrunk down into the microverse, wherever she is, may be. So, good art again. Herb Trimpe, John Severin. It always makes me think I'm reading an issue of Mad Magazine when Severin does the inks, and that's fine. It gives you something different to look at. Certainly competent. I agree with Tim's point about Hulk being far too quippy because, let's see, where was the line that really made me go, Hulk wouldn't say that. Yes. Enough to grab you and wad you up like little ball.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Hulk would say that if he's so dumb, perhaps, but he would do it. I've read worse Hulk books, I'll say that. Lorna Dane, unfortunately, does not get into costume in this issue. And her costumes are always good. And Alex Summers is, like Russell said, is never had a good comic costume, but I kind of like it when Neil Adams draws it. Nobody else does that as well to me. He does receive a long overdue redesign, although it's short-lived, in the 90s X-Factor comics.
Mm-hmm. I will say this about that goofy costume in this issue. I thought at first, yes, it serves a function. And I was like, oh my God, we just stopped everything for Havoc to make a costume change here. This is so bad. And then Goodwin, Archie Goodwin, very intelligently uses thought bubbles for Havoc to sort of justify why he had to go and do this, because the costume, in fact, helps him regulate his powers. So it wasn't just done for dramatic effect here, him getting into costume. It serves a functional purpose, and we're reminded of that. So I did enjoy that touch for something to really cover something that could have been extremely cheesy and even worse than it already is in this visual medium.
Gotcha. Moving on, let's check in with the undisputed best character in the Marvel Universe to this point in this podcast. That, of course, being Peter Parker, the Amazing Spider-Man. And we now have two ongoing titles that kind of feature Spider-Man. And first up this month, we're going to talk about Marvel Team-Up 3 and 4 that see Spider-Man having a return match against Morbius, kind of the rematch between Spider-Man and Morbius. The first issue, issue 3, sees him paired up with the Human Torch. The fourth issue sees him paired up with the X-Men. I'm not really sure why in the middle of this Morbius storyline, the Human Torch was there and then just decided, well, you've got this. I'm going to fuck off now. but I guess such is the nature of Marvel Team-Up. They're trying to rotate the characters in and out pretty quickly. So they have an encounter with Morbius, and then this professor character that they both are, you know, both know winds up going missing. And the X-Men believe it's because Spider-Man have abducted this professor, who, of course, is friends with Professor X. And it leads into a case of our heroes doing battle with one another before realizing they have a common enemy, which is always one of the greatest superhero tropes. And then it also leads to Spider-Man planning a farewell kiss on Jean Grey and Professor X looking like he's about to have a fucking aneurysm in the background when it happens. I'm guessing because he's so mad that he didn't think of it first that he just can't stand to watch another man put the moves on Gene. But all things considered, these Marvel Team-Up books honestly have not been up to the same par as the Spider-Man solo issues, but they're fun enough. Decent stuff here, nothing mind-blowing, just solid, entertaining kind of popcorn comics is the best way I can describe them. Todd, what'd you think?
I apologize for missing most of what you said about Marvel Team-Up because I spilled my wine and I've been cleaning that up. So,
appropriate?
Yes. That's a song, by the way, Spill the Wine. By who sings that song? I don't know.
Annie DeFranco, I believe.
No, she does not sing that song.
She should.
She should, yes. So, Marvel Team-Up 3... was okay, kind of. I'm not the Morbius guy, and I still kind of, why are we trying to do this anti-hero thing with him? Because it feels like that's where they want to go with it. Boy, I can't wait for the Morbius movie to fail spectacularly.
Probably won't, though.
Yeah, damn it.
No. Sony's got the momentum now.
And the issue with the X-Men, very interesting. First off, we get the X-Men shown in their original costumes as though this is a story that takes place in the past or somebody is not awake at the wheel. Stan is maybe not editing or Roy is not editing. There was another glitch or blooper that we should talk about? Yes, I just opened up to that classic Professor X looks at Spider-Man panel. But there is another one where they explain where Hank McCoy is, and apparently he is in the pages of not Amazing Adventures, but Amazing Fantasy. I'm missing it. But the editor's note was wrong, which is funny. It was
Astonishing Tales.
Astonishing Tales, yes.
Is that what they said?
That's what they said.
I missed that.
I do also like that we're slowly getting a bit of Spider-Man supporting cast in here. We get Harry Osborn in one of the pages. You do get Gil Kane drawing the X-Men, which is never, I haven't seen that before. That's interesting. It's very Gil Kane. And Gil Kane, of course, draws himself into a panel where, in the story where Spider-Man kidnaps the noted scientist that alerts Professor X. So Professor X is reading a newspaper and it features the story on the writer Gil Kane. Still decent. Nice to see Spider-Man being used with other characters. He would later team up with Iceman again in the pages, or I'm sorry, the television episodes of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. But Marvel team up still not nearly as good as Amazing Spider-Man. I'm sorry if you didn't say that or said that earlier. I don't know, but that's my take on it. I've got to go clean up some more wine.
Tim, your thoughts here.
Okay, so Marvel Team Up number 3, that was Jerry Conway and Ross Andrew. So kind of dig that Ross Andrew art, but I also really, really liked seeing Gil Kane draw the X-Men in issue 4, just because I don't know, I kind of enjoy Gil Kane in general. So I was sort of that was kind of a welcome artist change between the two issues. Human Torch does indeed fuck off in that third issue, and such is the way of Marvel Team-Up comics. That's the kind of convoluted way they have to execute this premise of guest stars sort of rotating in and out. A little bit jarring, for sure. That is the story of this series. Morbius. So, Morbius is back. I commented in his first appearances in Amazing Spider-Man that there were really a preponderance of coincidences. And for some reason, that continues to be the case here. Like, his old flame, Martine, goes to see the Fantastic Four because she knows this old colleague of Michael Morbius, and he used to correspond with Reed Richards, and that guy happens to be a professor at ESU, and he is not only a professor, but he's Peter Parker's professor, and Reed Richards doesn't act on this, but Johnny Storm overhears it, so it's just a lot of, okay, one thing to another thing to an, it's a lot to take in, right, to get us to this point. So that kind of irritated me a bit. But once we get past that third issue and it turns into, again, more of an X-Men story, I guess I was a bit more interested. Yeah, the original costumes, don't know what's up there. It also seems like the X-Men individually have been kind of depowered. They have a harder time with Morbius than I sort of think they should. But they're written as, I don't know, Jerry Conway seems to emphasize the weirdness of the X-Men, which I appreciate. They also come across as very, very mod, very 70s. And it makes me wonder what an early 70s X-Men comic might have been like. So it's interesting in that respect. But yeah, I mean, this doesn't set the world on fire. Again, we get a lot of characters jammed into just two issues, so I think it's worthwhile in that respect. And I don't know, I'll take my X-Men where I can get them. And by the way, Marvel Team Up number 4 has a hysterical, hilarious cover that was recently called out on Twitter for being so ridiculous, and I love it. So, yeah.
Russell, your thoughts?
Well, this is a story that exists. That's the most I can say for it. I'm not really that into it.
Wait a minute, Tim, is Spider-Man being blasted in the ass by a jet of ice?
No, by an optic blast.
Well, an optic blast to the back of the head, the ice looks like it's going straight into his ass.
Oh, well, that may very well be, but apparently the X-Men are very indifferent to Spider-Man falling to his death.
Other than to give him a little bit of the anal pleasure as he falls. In any event, Russell, I didn't mean to throw you off. Please continue.
I don't know. Blast of ice up the ass. That's
that tends to throw someone off.
The Iceman retcon continues.
Well done, Todd.
Well, the Iceman.
SJ Marvel W strikes again.
And here we are.
Sorry.
Although we have made this issue more interesting.
Harrison yes, just unsubscribed.
What a way to recontextualize, yeah.
Yeah, we've suddenly made this issue actually, you know, not so kind of bleh. Because that's what both of them were. Just kind of here. I mean, Gil Kane drawing X-Men, awesome. I'm still in it, Tim. I'm still wanting, you know, more X-Men, and I'll take them where I can get them. But, man, nobody had any good ideas, did they? You would think a team-up of Spider-Man and the X-Men would be just really great. It would be one of the best-selling one of the best comics you were ever going to read, and this ain't it. This is not... When the most interesting thing that happens is Professor X suddenly having the revelation that he could have done that all along. Thus is the story of Marvel team up. Rare miss really for Jerry Conway on Spider-Man, yeah, because the stuff that he does with Spider-Man later is actually real good. This just ain't it. The kidnapping of Professor Stan Lee just ain't doing it for me on this one. Morbius continuing to be forced into the whole, but he's really trying to be a good guy deep down. It's just his conditions, and I'm like, you know what? He's like, but my conditions. I'm sorry, I have no time for this. Johnny Storm was uninteresting in the issue. Nothing really of note seems to happen here. This is all just a rehash of Morbius's origin story, only to lead us into yet another. But he must feed, and oh, I must find a cure. Where have I heard this before? Oh, that's right. The Incredible Hulk already did this. There's really nothing here to write home about. It's unfortunate, too, because I was really looking forward to Spider-Man and the X-Men team up, and especially drawn by Gil Kane. That, at least it looked good, but it didn't do anything of note. So this is just one of those that, okay, read it. Let's move on now.
Yeah, I would agree as well. Fortunately for us, though, we had some more Spider-Man on this reading list in the form of Amazing Spider-Man 110 through 112. This kind of sees Spider-Man fighting a battle on two fronts. Of course, you have the personal front, a little bit of the melodramatic, self-loathing, guilt-ridden Peter front, as he is simultaneously having to deal with the return of Flash Thompson and Flash being the biggest douche on the face of the planet and putting the moves on Peter's woman constantly. And also, his Aunt May has gone into hiding after being accused of being overprotective of Peter. Gwen accuses her of this, and her response is, well, fuck all you. I'm just leaving. I'm taking off. I'm not going to stand for these insults. And so now Peter is worried that his frail old aunt is either out there dying or getting ramrodded by three dudes in a back alley somewhere.
Nobody's
really sure what the problem is here. He's having flashbacks to the time that she shacked up with Doc Ock and all this other weird stuff. Peter's very concerned about his aunt. And this aspect of Spider-Man, I have come to the realization that I'm never going to be able to get enough of it. You can have Peter be miserable and mopey for the rest of existence and have the most contrived, repetitive reasons for being so, and yet it's going to work for me because the supporting cast is that strong, the character is that strong, And he's a dude who just it's almost endearing to see the way that he can work through these things through the use of his costume personality. Now, on the other hand, these three issues also have to deal with the unfortunate villain of the Gibbon. And I think this character has got to be up there for the worst Spider-Man villain we've seen in the process of doing this podcast. And yet, as bad and stupid and cheesy as the Gibbon is, I love all the like soap opery melodrama of Peter Parker so much that I wind up liking these three issues anyway. It's pretty much gotten to a point where I realize this era of Spider-Man, there's not really much that they can do to turn me off in a big way. Maybe I'm wrong. Tim, am I wrong?
Okay, this is great because I think that Spider-Man to you is kind of like what Star Wars is to you.
Yeah. Where
even when it's bad, it's pretty good and you're going to be very forgiving of it. It's just sort of always going to work for you, right?
Right, pretty much.
It's, you know, it's pizza and sex. Even when it's bad, it's, you know, it's great.
Yeah, I still get to come. So I mean, you know.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, and I didn't hate this by any means.
You come when you eat pizza?
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, definitely. You sweat and you come.
Yeah.
Anyway,
fart, sneeze, and come all at the same time.
Oh. What's that called again?
I think that's called the Dusty. No, the Terry.
The Terry. Sorry, Terry. All right. Is it the fact that I'm getting older or that I'm just, you guys tell me, because I'm a big fat gay SJW that I get really sick of Peter's shit sometimes.
Yeah. I don't know how good you have it, man.
I just want to shake him and slap him. Like he doesn't really have it that bad. So when he whines about shit never going his way and it's due to some just fairly mundane problem that a person deals with, like, I don't find that empathetic. I just find it really self-absorbed. And I get that the hook of this character is his relatability. But I don't know. It just goes to show how that can be very limiting in its appeal and its effectiveness, especially over time. Sometimes relatability is overrated. There, I said it. And, you know, readers, they should challenge themselves to look outside of their own experiences and representations in much the same way that Peter Parker here should remove his own head from his ass. And that's a takeaway, maybe a hot takeaway that I did not expect in reading a lot of these early Spider-Man comics that we've done as part of this project. And for the most part, I would say this series and this character has been the most consistent and the most enjoyable that we've encountered. But it's kind of made me, I don't know, reevaluate in a small way my take on Spider-Man and Peter Parker. It's just maybe that nagging feeling that I've had for a little while now, reading this book. And for of all things, this to be jarred loose by a Gibbon story.
God. Like,
the Gibbon, what's his name? Martin Blank. He's a total sad sack lame-o loser.
He happens to look like a Gibbon.
Looks so handsome like he could
Gibbon. Which I didn't know what the fuck a Gibbon was until I read this issue for the
record. Yeah. I guess maybe he's a mutant. They don't really explicitly say that, but it's
kind of a beast-like situation.
Yeah, it seems like a beast kind of situation. And something.
A simpleton
as well. Yes, and it all just adds up to this character who is pitiful in a way that Peter Parker kind of isn't, and I guess there's always someone out there who has it worse than you do. Yeah. But the Gibbon, his self-loathing comes through in a way that is almost more valid than Peter's, especially when it's juxtaposed in this kind of story. I don't know if that was like the intended effect of these issues here, but it definitely makes for a deeper reading than I thought I was going to have going into something starring the Gibbon in his great debut, this amazing character find of 1972. This, by the way, another Stan Lee swan song. ASM number 110 is the last Stan Lee Amazing Spider-Man comic. Can you believe that?
I can't. I cannot. Russell, I'm interested to hear your take on this three-parter, and also, Tim, your take on Tim's take.
Yeah, Tim hurt everybody's feelings, I think.
I try.
He really does. But, you know, Tim is not completely wrong. Peter Parker is a bit of a whiny bitch at times, and sometimes that goes a little overboard. But, I mean, the only person who's really, like, truly important are the two most important people in his life, being Gwen and Aunt May, seem to be a bit at odds, you know, as at odds as these types of relationships seem to be portrayed in the 70s get. And one of them just completely fucks off and disappears. So that
who's
that
the smartest
him?
Person in the story, which is amazing to say of Aunt May.
She's like, you know what? Kind of feel like I've had enough of this shit. I'm going to go on and do my own thing for a little while. But I'm going to leave you with this nice, lovely note that's going to send you on a guilt trip, too. So, you know, Aunt May gets to get the double shot in there. That's nice. I can get on board with this. I can get on board with all of the drama around Peter's personal life. All of that works for me. What doesn't work for me isn't actually the Gibbon. What's not working for me is Kraven. I hate him. I really do. Every time Kraven pops up, I can't stand it. It's like he is just uninteresting. There's nothing good happening here. It's boring. It is, boy, is it convoluted whenever he and the Gibbon get together. It is like, oh my dear God, does this ever end? Get me back to miserable Peter Parker. Get me back inside the Daily Bugle as quickly as possible. That part was fun. All the J. Jonah Jameson stuff always works. The, you know, Kraven really should work better than he does, but he's not being handled well here. Maybe he doesn't actually get good until, you know, his death. Maybe that's when we're going to get a good Kraven story, but this is another one of those that just ain't it. I mean, Jerry Conway actually takes over writing that second issue of these three that we read, and again, it was not that good. It really wasn't. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, the next issue, when there is no Gibbon and no Kraven whatsoever, we're just dealing with Peter Parker looking for Aunt May. I actually started to get paranoid right along with Peter. I started thinking, "Oh my God, is Aunt May actually like gone because she chose to be, or did somebody take her?" You start to, like, at first it seems ridiculous. Yeah, right? Like, who doesn't want to explore that dusty hooch? You know, it's just one of those moments that at first it seems really dumb. This is really ridiculous. What is this? Mary Jane Watson's aunt even like talking about here? Did Aunt May get kidnapped? Who would kidnap this old lady? And then all of a sudden, Peter's mind starts to flip that other direction. And if you were as invested in it as I was, you start to kind of follow him down that rabbit hole, and you find yourself getting paranoid right along with him. And it all leads up to this, what I think is a great ending to that issue, a big, like, awesome reveal of the return of Doc Ock. And whenever we got to that point and it stopped, I started to think, you know, I know that the next issues aren't part of our reading list this time. They're part of part three, but I almost just decided to keep run on going because I needed to know what happened next. Jerry Conway found his footing with Spider-Man, and now he's working with Doc Ock, who's an infinitely more interesting villain than Kraven. I foresee good things in the future for Jerry Conway's run, especially with John Romita drawing. We hadn't even mentioned that yet, but John Romita's art,
yes,
is real good.
Oh, he's back.
Yep.
Yeah, John Romita comes out swinging in all of these issues. Even when it's boring, it's still good. Even when it's in those boring moments with Kraven, this is still some really great art. John Romita shows off quite a bit why he is considered one of the all-time greats. I do miss Gil Kane a little bit, but I'll forget about it by the next issues because so long as John Romita keeps going, I'm fully on board. This was still good stuff.
Absolutely. You bring up Kraven. It's kind of weird because he catches this elaborate revenge plot, and then when it fails, instead of doing anything about it, he just sits there and goes, "Oh well, guess I'm not going to go out and attack Spider-Man directly." Kind of comes off very poorly, I think.
That's why he still sucks
at the ending of that that issue. Todd, your thoughts here?
See, I don't think pardon me, Jerry Conway likes Kraven either. Maybe Stan said, "Okay, and the trick is." Is that Craven's going to turn the Gibbon into a superstar. But now that Ben is no longer affiliated with the show, I can take my shots at Stan. We have...
What was stopping you before, let's face it?
No, we didn't take shots. We just... It's all in good fun.
It's all in good fun. And so 110 and 111, we have the Gibbon. And good Lord, the Gibbon is something. I feel like the Gibbon is feels like somebody we may interact with sometimes in our life. I don't know if he's necessarily a wrestling.
We all have a Gibbon in our lives.
We do. In our families sometimes.
God, if you're on Facebook, you have three or four Gibbons. At least.
Some Gibbons don't like AEW wrestling. So
some of you are in, never mind. Yeah. Never mind.
Sometimes there are total shit Gibbons at that.
But yeah, Kraven comes in to give the Gibbon some purpose and some direction and elevate him as a heel. And Kraven wears ballet slippers. That's all there is to it. There are no good Kraven stories until Kraven's last time. In my predictions, I've never liked a Kraven story. I've never gotten it ever.
Todd, I'm gonna be honest. I haven't heard a single word you've said because now I've got this mental image of a panel of the Gibbon saying, "I thought tonight's Raw was a pretty good episode," and I'm just sitting here giggling to myself.
Peter Parker just described something terrible that happened to him, and the Gibbon said, "It wasn't that bad."
It wasn't that bad.
Okay, but let's get to 112, issue 112. We will talk about why this is a special issue to Todd Weber in just a moment. Again, we get a recap of Peter and his relationship with Aunt May, and let's talk about that. Is Peter being a whiny bitch, or is he feeling extraordinarily guilty about the whole thing, or should he just dial back and be maybe angry at Gwen for this? I don't know. Because, come on, if it doesn't work out with Gwen, it's not like you don't have any options. You have Mary Jane Watson, right? Come on.
Well,
old to have those problems. And Spider-Man is a cyclical book. He's going to work through this. He's going to triumph for a while as well and not be a whiny bitch. But that's the cycle of Spider-Man. It happens where it's perpetual. That's just who he is and how the book works, and it's up to the writers to give you interesting stories, characters, what have you, throughout. Now, Doc Ock comes back. We have him a little foreshadowed in this issue with the Aunt May recap.
That was nicely done.
Mm-hmm. I like that, too. I couldn't remember when that happened, you know, so I knew that it had happened. I didn't know if it was before the story or not. I couldn't quite remember all that. Again, the mental image of Aunt May being kidnapped when we know that's not the case. Aunt May is on a church bus somewhere just doing things, and this will all blow over because Aunt May, nothing bad can happen to Aunt May. And even if it does, they're going to walk it back because that's how Marvel works. Wonderful, wonderful art. And Conway, I think, gets a little bit more of the voice of Spider-Man in the classic Stan style as this goes. So I'm good with all these. Now, issue 112 is special to me because when I was in 8th grade, my parents were relocating from the city, my dad and stepmom, to the country. They were buying a house in a suburb, and this house, this town had a what do you call it, the old town, the main street, you know, these old ancient buildings from the old West. And in there was a thrift shop, and my parents brought me back this particular comic when they were going out to look at the house in the country that they ended up buying. So I still have it. It was maybe one of my first Silver Age. No, I'm sorry, Bronze Age. Maybe the earliest issue of Spidey I had found at that point. And it was, I've always thought it was really special because they thought of me and did that, because they hadn't necessarily been that supportive of my comic habit.
Hadn't thought of you
at that point. You know, maybe they're just bracing me. Hey, okay, Todd, we're going to move a half hour away. You're going to have to change schools yet again. But anyway, I still have it, and I love this cover, even though it's Spidey whining. Sure, you know, I don't care anymore. I do like the image of him with the. I've always thought of this as the sausage or the cut up hot dog hands, the way his fingers look there. Anyway, all right, moving on.
No, I agree with you. I actually really like this cover too. And at first, I thought that, you know, they were really going to pay off that whole, like, this is, or this was going to be another Spider-Man quits issue.
Spider-Man 50.
But then they flipped that around, and he kind of rediscovers purpose, like, very quickly, or, you know, gets out of his own head and starts, like, concentrating on what he really needed to be focused on in the first place, which was, you know, the search for Aunt May, and, like, realizing that he does still have other responsibilities. So, I'm with you there, Todd. 112 actually is a really great issue of Amazing Spider-Man.
And I had read this issue out of context for many years. You know, I had not the lead up to it, even though I'd read some of the earlier Spider-Man stuff through Marvel Tales reprint books for 50 cents back in the day.
Yeah, as a standalone issue, I think it works. I think you get filled in on the background stuff enough to be able to go forward without having to necessarily go back and endure the Gibbon and Kraven.
Right. Yeah, you don't learn just how ridiculous the Gibbon is. You just know he's a guy in a hospital, and the suit, burn the suit.
Did you identify that as your first comic book?
But maybe my first really old. I don't think I had owned a comic that was this old, and it was in great shape, you know, bagged and boarded and found in an antique shop back when comic shops were hard to come by.
So it was just kind of a back issue that your parents randomly picked up.
That's randomly picked up. And what's the date on this? It's what's the month on it?
It is September 72.
Okay, so it probably came out like April, March, or early summer.
Yeah. Very cool.
Always good to hear those personal stories.
Yeah, I think everybody's got a story like that. You know, your parents getting you the random comic that means nothing to them, but you still remember and hold in this disproportionately high esteem.
Yeah, like I'd been reading comics for a long time. It was just a matter of getting one that was gifted to me as okay, very nice. I guess they don't hate that I like this.
I have many stories like that, yeah.
As opposed to my mother, you know, my parents are divorced, and she threw away my whole collection when I moved to
the house.
Well, you know, Todd, that's interesting you should bring up your childhood. I'm sure you watched children's television programming when you were a child back in the 70s.
Oh, God.
Much like the children featured in Marvel Featured number 3 watched children's television programming. Except I'd like to think, Todd, that your television programming wasn't trying to convince you to leave the planet to go off with this weird space creature and never to return to Earth, which is exactly the plot of this Defenders issue of Marvel Feature number 3. Man, this is certainly a unique situation, is the only way I can think to describe this. I have to say, if they are trying to set up the Defenders as the answer, as the good alternative to what Avengers is supposed to be, as a team book done right, they are not off to a rip-roaring start with stories such as these. Bizarre and goofy, but not in a fun way, just in kind of a dumb, I can't believe I'm reading this way. That was my take on Marvel Feature number 3. Perhaps I'm wrong. Russell, what'd you think here?
That you are indeed not wrong. That you are 100% right on. This was weird. Just over the top odd. What are we doing? If the Seinfeld I'm out gif were like put into a comic book form and given life for 24 pages, I think this is what it would look like. This is an exercise in absurdity. And that's saying something for the company that just like 10 years prior to this gave us those early Fantastic Four stories. This, I don't know what to say for it. Even the artwork is not a redeeming quality here. This is not the best work I think anybody's ever turned in. This creature that they're using, and I shit you not, at one point even throwing pies at, looks like the Abominable Snowman. And oh my God, I don't even know what to say for it, other than this starts off boring and goes into the extreme absurd with this idea that, oh, this alien creature took over the mind of an astronaut, and his buddy or his partner doesn't even notice anything weird about the happenings afterwards. He just goes right along with, yeah, let's start a TV show and convince kids that we're all going to like take them off world to a much better place. Was there ever really a point to that part of the story? Probably not. It was just a thing. Maybe he was going to eat the kids. I don't know. I kind of gave up paying attention to this after a while. And, you know, I just did what I could to get to the end of it. But, my God. Hulk doesn't even show up until like the last couple pages because he was mad that Doctor Strange impersonated him. That was the part where I almost fully checked out of the issue. I was like, Bruce Banner sees Hulk on television. And he's like, wait a minute, I'm not there. Somebody else is there and looks like Hulk. Oh, that pisses me off that somebody's impersonating Hulk and I'm going to turn into him right now. No. That's dumb. Whoever wrote that, that makes no sense. Why would Bruce Banner be pissed off about that? I would think he'd be like, oh, good. They can go chase somebody else for a little
because
while.
Because Roy Thomas.
Keep living my life.
Why.
Yeah.
Because Roy He's Thomas. Like,
and then the Hulk gets pissed later on for Doctor Strange insinuating that he has a small brain.
Yes. It's like, this is Defenders. As Nick said, not off to a good start here. I think I'm already to the point where I'm like, you know what? Let's go ahead and throw in the towel on this. Submariner was right from the jump. This is a bad idea. This is not a team. It maybe no, it couldn't have been. Never mind. Just go right on ahead and skip this. This is just absurd and stupid.
They're not helped by the fact that they've dropped the least interesting character. The Silver Surfer is off
right, yes,
doing something else. Like you can't do it. Have a quartet and drop the only character that really has been developed over the course of his appearances in the Marvel Universe. It just doesn't make any sense.
Nothing about this made any sense. They have this. Is he changing into this creature? Did I read that right? Like that's how I interpret it. This is not a suit. This is him as he like looks as the creature persona or the alien persona takes over his body and mind. Exactly.
Yes, is the answer.
You get to this point where you're like, even as a kid, like if you were reading this as a kid, you'd have to start picking this apart. This can't make any sense to you. It's real, real dumb, real bad. There's a reason that this team did not become much of a thing. And this issue is a clear example of why. This sucked. It's one of those rare occasions where you got not one, but two full Seinfeld GIF out issues in the same reading list. I'm going to put this one right up there with Avengers 100 as being as that bad. But I actually did make it to the end of this, but I think it was because I was in a mood to read comics and hope that this was going to pull itself back from the brink.
Oh, come on.
Roy and Thomas. It didn't. Yeah. I know. I've learned my lesson. Like if I see Roy Thomas's name in the writing a team book, I'm already going to just go ahead and lower my expectations to the floor and maybe I'll get through it. But now this and Avengers 100 equally bad.
Tim, I heard you giggling and reacting here during Russell's evaluation of the issue. I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
I don't think it's equally as bad as Avengers 100 because, for one thing, I did finish this issue. I did not think it was difficult to actually finish. I did not find it boring. I mean, it's pretty dreadful. Yeah, I mean, it sucks, but it wasn't really, it didn't challenge me in the way that Avengers number 100 did. So I guess on that basis, I was sort of okay with it in terms of, to the extent that you can be okay with a bad comic. The plot almost, it almost feels like a, I thought initially that it felt like a standalone episode of the X-Files, one of their more offbeat type of episodes, but now I'm sort of wondering, had Kolchak the Night Stalker started yet? Like, are we too early in the 70s for that to be a thing?
Didn't somebody reference Night Stalker in one of these issues, though?
Yes, I think they did. Maybe in, I don't know, maybe one of those...
Marvel Team Up? Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't start till 74, but I think it was adapted from something.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case, it just feels like Roy Thomas is doing a send-up of something, but I have
no idea.
It
was preceded by two television movies, The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler. The Night Stalker aired in 1972.
There we go.
All right. I don't know. Maybe that was an influence, but I have no idea what Roy Thomas is riffing on, but it seems like there's something. Like, he's trying to do a social commentary, and it's just, like, misfiring.
What it is? It's Scientology, Tim.
Scientology?
I think it's about Scientology.
Dianetics, maybe?
Yeah, because you take the M out of Zemnu, and you have Xenu.
Oh, wow. So, okay, so...
And I'm going to take you all into space with me.
So L. Ron Hubbard had written, like, his shitty science fiction books at this point.
Yeah, Battlefield Earth. I don't know. I'm just throwing this out there because of the names.
No, I think maybe he cracked it there.
This character was used... This was a Stan Lee monster book creation who, you know, had previously enslaved all the children. So maybe it's a Stan Lee thing. I don't know.
Yeah, and... So it's questions. Roy Thomas doing a callback to an earlier character, which is something Roy Thomas does a lot, but I think he is putting his own spin on it with the whole children follow me to this planet, and it's a little bit creepy, and we don't know what is going to come of that, but okay. Yeah, so this is our introduction to the Defenders, guys, these three issues, and... Like Russell, I was very confused by the absence of the Silver Surfer and these three issues of Marvel Feature, because combinations of this quartet of characters have interacted in one another's solo books up to this stage, and yet you get no Silver Surfer for some reason. So, all right, I guess we're all really looking forward to Defenders, right?
I don't know. Todd, your thoughts here.
I mean, it's just convenient that Surfer is gone because he's the big cosmic dude, and here's this villain with a cosmic plan. So maybe it would have been hard to write, especially for Roy Thomas, your way out of that. So it's easier just to take the Surfer off the board. I don't know. Ross Andrew art, but with Bill Everett inks, giving it kind of a Golden Age look. And boy... Do they draw Urban Rick Jones / Jim Wilson in a strange way with this oversized head? Does not work for me. This is not the best comic I've ever read. I want my money back. Except that it's part of my subscription. The other thing about Zemnu is that he looks like Gossamer from the Looney Tunes, you know, that character, the big orange guy with the eyes.
Oh, that's what it was.
And I think that's what's going, you know, I don't know if that's going on with the kids show here, but...
I never knew that was the character's name, but I know exactly what you mean now.
But yeah, this is weird. Roy was on some weird drugs at this point, I'm going to say. I don't want to read it again.
Helmet. Oh, yeah.
I don't want to read any more Defenders. I think I'm done.
Well, strap in.
Sadly, we have Avengers Defenders War still yet to come.
That's right.
I'm sure that'll be a barn burner.
This is the NWO B team of comic books.
What, the 1970s? Yes.
Well, speaking of the NWO B team and the 1970s, here's a book that would certainly deserve inclusion on such a B team. We're going to wrap up our discussion in this episode with a book that must be read to be believed, as Night Nurse makes her debut in the pages of Night Nurse number one. Now, this was part of an effort by Marvel to expand into the female readership, to get more females reading their titles. Now, we read something like this in last episode, where we had Shanna the She-Devil, where we saw a strong woman taking action and, you know, taking the fight to people and taking some agency in her own story. This, however, not so much, as we are introduced to a trio of, well, nursing students who have to solve the problems that nurses do in the neighborhood and in the ways of love. And I don't even I can't even find words to describe how fucking just inane this book was. Like, it reads like someone wanted to write a parody of a romance comic, and this is what came out. It was like one of those, we forced a bot to read 1,000 romance comics from the 50s and 60s, and this is the script it wrote. It is just so cliched, and just everything about it is awful. Just awful. There are no redeeming qualities, in my view anyway. Tim, tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, you're wrong because the Marvel bullpen, even though they did not know any black writers, Roy Thomas does know a woman. In fact, he's married to a woman. So, on the one hand...
Why didn't they let Joan Lee write it? Damn it.
On the one hand, we have a
20 pages of shopping
Siri. Wow. A female-centric solo series written by a woman. On the other hand, go nepotism, I guess. Yeah, it's not great. It's something that the title Night Nurse, doesn't that suggest like that it's going to be a little bit more adventurous or thrilling?
Or maybe even like risque in a way.
Risque, perhaps. And it's just so mundane. I mean, medical...
They just work in a hospital.
They're just nursing students, and they work in a hospital. And, I mean, I'll tell you, medical dramas are like low-key my favorite television drama. But I think it's kind of hard to translate the just pace and the energy and the something always happening of a medical drama to the printed page. And on top of that, nothing is really happening here. We get this kind of romance subplot with our lead character, Linda, the night nurse, I guess. She meets...
They call
this,
night nurses, like they're three lead.
Kind of should, yeah. There's three. She is sort of the standout, but...
Well, you've also got Christine Palmer, who would go on to be featured in Doctor Strange, of course. So there's that.
Her introduction here. But Linda, she meets this patient who, of course, she's going to fall in love with. And he is such a chode that he not only wants to quit her chosen profession, he will not wait 2 days for her to fucking graduate. And this is presented as a genuine conflict that we're supposed to buy into.
Like, right.
Are you kidding me? This is absurd.
Well, and by the same token, we're also supposed to buy as a genuine conflict the father's offer to Christine. Yeah. All right, you did a great job graduating. Now you can either work for the rest of your life or do nothing and just have all this money for free. Now maybe yes. It's just me, and maybe a lot of other people would disagree with this. But if somebody makes that same choice to me or offers that same choice to me, I'm going to choose nothing every time.
If
nothing
it is presented,
and money over work.
Yes. If it is presented in such broad, mutually exclusive terms, yeah, that's a pretty easy decision. And that's what this comic is. It's a very this or that kind of thing. And it's like, oh my God, what high drama, what conflict. Oh, it's so nuanced. What will they do? Like, well, they all do the thing that you completely expect them to do, because that's what this comic is. And I don't know, maybe if this was an actual romance comic, then it's Linda, you know, walking away from her career for love, you know, because that's how all those sorts of stories ended. And it's like, well, we're going to flip that on their head here, because now it's 1972 and these are liberated women. It's real bad. It's an effort that I can appreciate, but
while giving them the most massive failing grade for execution.
It is so poorly executed. Yes.
Todd, your thoughts here on Night Nurse.
This is hot. This is
it's hot. Wow.
This is my kind of evening reading, as you say. That's everybody should say. No, this is goofy as all get out. And St. Georgia, my goodness, nothing bad happens to Georgia Jenkins. She's angelic. She doesn't have to choose to be rich or be a nurse. She doesn't have that choice. Georgia should tell Linda what to do, right?
Right.
Or Chris what to do. This guy is creepy. I don't know. This Marshall Michaels, there's something going on with him, but we never see him again. Somebody should integrate him into the Marvel Universe as a Saudi prince or something undercover. Would make sense. This is a bizarre comic. Linda Carter, not that Linda Carter, but Linda Carter cries on no less than 8 different pages of this comic. 8.
And crying is what brings them all together. They all hate each other until mm-hmm. she starts crying, and then they love each other.
The only other comment I have, because we gotta wrap this up. This is I guess we could do a full show on this. Maybe Geek and Sassy can read this comic and talk about it. But the art kind of reminds me of Bill Sienkiewicz. Tim, did you think that at all throughout, or am I just high on the crack again?
Maybe Bill Sienkiewicz when he's not. On the good drugs.
Yeah, when he's doing a dream sequence or something like that. Or I got maybe a little bit of the Sandman, early Sandman, Mike Drinchenberg thing.
Those I could
see
that.
I see the Sandman thing now, too. But
the artist is Winslow Mortimer.
Yeah, golden and silver age artist who did mostly Superman books.
Okay, did not know that.
Russell, your thoughts on Night Nurse? Fascinating as always.
Russell, come back.
He may have fallen asleep. And who can blame him after reading Night Nurse?
Russell!
Well,
it happens. I know better than anyone.
Night Nurse. It could happen to the best of us.
Perhaps he had an emergency.
Whoop.
Am I back in yet?
There yes. he is.
Oh, there I am.
That's what he said.
Yes, something
being tended to by a night nurse.
I have no idea. Thing just cut me off for some reason. Who knows? But anyway, I'm back in, and it's like I was about to say. Was the only thing I could think of was Todd found the adaptation of Night Nurses from Jersey, and that's where he was going with that. So that's for all you '90s movies fans out there who saw Little Big League. Yeah, this was bad. This was a bad issue, but you know, it was still hilarious enough that I kept going with it just so I could see where this was going to wind up. If it was going to wind up in the like most awful of places that I thought it would, and it did. So, hey,
that's
at least
true. I can give it that.
You know, at least I got to the end.
Yeah.
Which is more than I can say for Avengers 100. So, Night Nurse number one, congratulations. You are not the biggest piece of shit on this list. I actually made it to the end of you. So
It is entertaining, if only unintentionally. Like, even if they aren't setting out to succeed in being a parody, it is somehow a successful parody of romance comics and other equally bullshit comics from, you know, around this era that I can find a certain charm about it, even if we all acknowledge that it's pretty awfully executed. But
and it's different. It's very different.
Yeah, different's a word. But with all that being said, we have reached the end of this month's reading list. Be sure to come back for part three of our discussion on 1972. And to give you an idea of what we'll be covering there real quick, we'll be taking a look at Thor 200, Amazing Spider-Man 113 to 115, God Help Us, Avengers 102 through 104.
Warlock. That's the end of the Roy Thomas stuff.
Warlock 1 to 3, Marvel Spotlight 5, Daredevil 90 to 91, God Help Us, Defenders 1 through 3, Captain America 153 to 156, and The Cat, Ernest Miller, number 1. So, be sure to stick around with this podcast and come back for part three of our discussion in 1972. But before we leave you, we will end this episode as we do each and every episode with giving every member of the panel an opportunity to plug their shit. I, of course, am Nick Duke. I can be found on the Twitter machine at NickDuke87, sometimes participating on the Place to Be Nation comics Facebook page, and also over at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, where we just dropped our last episode of Walking Dead Month, where we reviewed another shitty volume of the Walking Dead comic. And then our next episode that is coming up is currently scheduled to be, I think we're going to take a look back at the Josh Trank Fantastic Four from 2015 in the latest edition of Fix It or Nix It, or whatever we've decided to call that recurring feature at this point. Work in progress, to be sure. In any event, Tim, what do you got going on?
On the Twitter machine, follow me at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-68, other podcasts that I am a part of. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, sister feed, I am one-third of Talking WCW with Jennifer Smith and Greg Phillips. We talked about Man Called Sting in our most recent episode, so if that's your bag, check it out. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. And enjoy as well the Three Michaels theory, courtesy of Greg Phillips. Nick, your illustrious co-host, which kind of blew everyone's mind.
There are so many things from those Hooters years of pay-per-view watching that would have blown your mind. I mean, it really was a time and place that had to be seen to be believed.
I'm still kind of shook over that. Also with Jennifer Smith, I co-host Talkin' Pop, and that is on part of the Jenny Position podcast. So you'll want to search Jenny Position, total separate podcast feed. But yeah, that show that we do together, still going strong on in the Jenny Position.
There you are. Todd, plug your shit.
So, I once saw, it sounds like a Larry Kingism, huh? I went to a show and I saw a live dance-off between Ernest the Cat Miller and the late, great James Brown. That was something. Late Super Brawl. We couldn't believe it. It was like, is that really James Brown? And it was. It was James Brown.
Oh, you went to that show.
I was at that show. I saw it with my own eyes, not just on the network, but I was there.
What Super Bowl was that?
2000.
2000.
Yeah, I thought so.
2000. That was the last one that was in San Francisco, Northern California. I think the 2001, or did they not have it? Anyway, this is not Talking WCW. This is Marvel Age Podcast. On DC for You every Wednesday/Thursday for about another month, and we are on a hiatus. Check out Place to Be Nation Pop on Facebook and subscribe if you are not already subscribing. I got nothing else than that. You're not interested in my social media because you'll be offended one way or the other. Oh, and the 49ers are 7-0, so that's kind of cool.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It is cool.
Russell, plug your shit, sir.
The Falcons are not 7-0.
No.
It was a rough day.
The Atlanta Hawks are 2-0, though, for the record.
Well, there we go. At least
in the pitiful East. The,
careful, though. It's Atlanta sports. Don't get your hopes up, Hawks fans. They'll let you down, too.
No.
But in any case, yes, you can find me on the Twitter and the Instagram machine at Russell_Sellers. And I even come with that theme music that you just heard every time you log on to my stuff. So it's a fun little ditty. Keep it going.
You come also, with it.
Yeah, I come with a thunder tip there, right. Every time.
Father now, come chauffeur.
Yeah, I come with father time, you see.
4 stars.
Now, speaking of that, you can find me and Todd on DC4U. As he mentioned, we got another month of shows before we go on a hiatus. We're going to do a Green Lantern celebration because Green Lantern Rebirth just hit 15 years old. So we're doing a little celebration of that along with the Four Corpsmen debut issues, and we're going to be taking a look at the first episode of Green Lantern, the animated series, all within the next month of shows, until we, of course, wrap it up with a final current events for the month of November. Then, like Todd said, we're going to be on a little bit of a hiatus till season 2 comes back, and we've got we're in the planning process of that now. Lots of cool stuff coming up. So, be on the lookout also for the return of 90 to Nothing, my all 90s movies podcast with Sam Neely. We've been in the process of putting some episodes together for you guys, looking at all movies from the year 1990, as those movies are all turning 30 years old in 2020. Ooh. So we're going down a list of about 12 of what we consider to be either the most influential, best, or just infamous movies of the year 1990. So be sure to look for that starting in December.
Dick Tracy.
I can't say if it's on the list or not, but it might be.
Darkman.
His friends call him Richard, for the record.
Sooner is better than later or never. Oh, Breathless Mahoney. Good God.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
The Rocketeer, was that 1990?
It was not. It was 1991.
Ah, okay. Oh, Silence of the Lambs.
Yep.
So whoever that was just turned into a middle schooler on TikTok, I believe.
All right, well, check out all those shows. Check out all the great shows here on Place to Be Nation Wrestling and Place to Be Nation Pop. Of course, be back with us when we reconvene for part 3 of our 1972 discussion. With all of that said, we hope you've enjoyed this. We'll see you next time. Enough said.